I could keep this up for an hour or two. If he fights like he was before, then a half hour, maybe a bit more. Aluminum is easier than steel. What are we going to do with him?
Jail's not an option, Adam said. I'll call Bran, but I expect we're not going to have a choice but to call on the Fae.
Tad grunted unenthusiastically. If someone told them I'm not as powerless as most of us halfies, they would want me to join them. Maybe someone can contact my dad and he can take credit for this.
There was a metallic sound, as if he'd tossed something at the metal prison he'd created from my nice Wasserboxer engine.
Hey, Mercy, did you know there's a finger in the back seat of this Passat? Tad asked.
I broke free of Adam and went into the garage to check out the Passat as I started to add up the damage. I'd need to get another Wasserboxer engine to replace the one that melted. The Beetle engine had been no loss, but the Passat was going to need some body work. The finger had melted all the way through the roof, through the lining, and dropped onto the off-white leather, where it left a small puddle of blood and black ash. It looked like anyone else's finger.
He pulled off his finger and threw it at me, I told Tad. Do you know of any Fae that pull off body parts and throw them at people?
I think there are some German folk tales about disembodied heads, he said doubtfully. And then there's always Thing on the Addams Family.
He opened the back door of the car and touched the finger.
It's not moving.
I hugged myself and fought the urge to giggle. Thank the good Lord for small favors.
Adam moved Tad gently aside and used a hanky to pick up the finger and bring it to his nose.
I don't smell magic as well as you do, Mercy, he said, setting it back on the seat. But this finger smells human, not fey.
Human fingers don't, Tad interrupted me. He jerked his head around until he faced his metal sculpture and made a pained sound. He staggered off balance, and Adam caught his elbow to steady him.
Sweat broke out on Tad's brow, and he said in a guttural tone,
"Watch out! Something is wrong!"
The whole building shook again. There was a thunderous crash as a transmission fell off the top shelf of a gorilla rack. Adam grabbed my hand and held on to me. It was a hand I burned, but I just grabbed him back. Some things are more desperate than pain. It lasted less than a second, and it left the cement floor of my shop buckled, car parts and boxes of car parts strewn all over. The high-pitched wail of the office smoke detector went off. It went off with some frequency when I showered too long or someone cooked bacon in the microwave, but it had ignored all the smoke and fires in the garage. Apparently it had decided that enough was enough. Adam dropped his hold on Tad and me, grabbed his ears and snarled. I knew exactly how he felt, and I knew what to do. I dashed into the office, hopped onto the counter, and snagged the stool as I jumped. I set the stool on the counter and climbed on top with speed and balance hard won with practice. Reaching up to the ceiling, I popped the battery out of the alarm. Blessed silence fell. Relative silence, broken by things that were still rolling onto the floor and the sirens that were closer now. In the parking lot, a car engine purred to life, then revved hard as someone drove off with a squeal of rubber on asphalt. I looked out the window and saw Juan Flores's rental car speeding away. Tad was swearing in German. Some of the words I recognized, but even the ones I didn't echoed my own sentiment exactly.
Stupid, he said to me, his eyes horror-struck. I am so stupid. Er war Erde und Feuer. English, murmured Adam.
Earth and fire, said Tad without pause. Earth and fire. And I trapped him and forgot what he was.
Earth.
Tad clenched his fist and pulled at something invisible with enough force that it caused his muscles to stand out on his arms. With an almost human shriek, the aluminum that had encased Flores peeled back, revealing a cavernous hole where the cement floor of my garage had once been. Adam's head came up, and he measured the sound of the sirens.
Stay here, he said, and hopped down into the hole.
He was gone less than a minute before he was back. He looked at Tad.
You need to be out of here before those sirens get close. Can you change your appearance so no one will recognize you?
Tad nodded.
Change shape, then, Adam said. You understand that it won't just be the police coming here. Even the dumbest cop is going to see that there was magic afoot here. We're going to have government agents, and if they get a glimpse of what you can do, they are going to want you. You are too powerful for anyone to let you run around loose, human, shapeshifter, or fae. No one but your dad knows exactly how powerful you are. Let's leave it like that.
Tad changed like I do, between one breath and the next. He was a little taller than usual, and a lot handsomer. He looked clean-cut and real. I wondered if he'd stolen the appearance from someone, or if he practiced in front of a mirror.
"That's good," said Adam. "Go."
"Thank you," I told him. He grinned, and Tad's grin looked odd on the stranger's face.
"You aren't supposed to thank the Fae, Mercy. You're just lucky I like you."
Then he strolled casually outside and away. Adam pulled out his cell phone.
"Jim, get rid of all copies of the feed to Mercy's garage after I hit Floris with the engine. Blur or get rid of anything that shows Mercy's assistant after he left when she closed up."
"Got it."
He hung up the phone and looked at me. He'd seen it faster than I had. Tad was incredibly powerful to do what he'd done. He was also young, and with his father locked away in Fairyland, the Ronald Wilson Reagan Fay Reservation's less respectful nickname, he was vulnerable. No one but family could know what he was. I looked at the sheet of aluminum now crumpled and torn aside. It could have been an airplane or a tank or... We needed to keep him safe.
"The hole goes underground out to the parking lot."
"He told me his name was Guayota," I said. And that's when I saw the naked dead man lying on the floor where a dead dog should have been. I blinked twice, and he was still there, belly down, but his head turned to the side, so I could see the single bullet hole in his forehead. My bullet hole. "Adam," I said, and my voice was a little high. He turned his head and saw the man, too.
"Who is that?"
"I think," I said slowly, "I think that's the dog I shot." I remembered that too intelligent, ancient gaze.
"I saw it on my laptop on the way over," Adam said. "You shot a dog."
"It wasn't a dog," I gave a half-hysterical hiccup. "They'll arrest me for murder."
"No,"
Adam said. "Are you sure?" I sounded a little more pathetic than usual. My face hurt. My garage was in ruins. It would make my insurance company run to find their acts of God not covered clause. I'd killed a dog that had turned into a naked dead guy, and someone had thrown a finger at me.
"Floris essentially ate your gun, so no weapon for ballistics," Adam said, "and you were attacked in your garage."
He didn't say any more out loud, but I heard what he left unspoken. There wasn't a member of the local police department who hadn't seen or at least heard of the recording of what had happened to me in this garage before, if only because the imagery of Adams ripping apart the body of my assailant left a big impression. His arms closed around me, and we both looked at the dead man. He looked like someone's uncle, someone's father. His body was spare and muscled in a way that looked familiar. Werewolves don't have extra fat on their bodies either. They burn calories in the change from human to wolf and back, and they burn calories moving because a werewolf doesn't have the proper temperament to be a couch potato.
"Sweetheart," Adam said,
his voice a sigh as the first official car pulled into my parking lot.
"It was clear-cut self-defense."
I closed my eyes and leaned against him.
"Hands up," said a shaky voice. "Get your hands up where I can see them."
Adam let go of me and put his hands up. I turned around, stepping away from Adam so they could tell I wasn't armed. The man approaching us wasn't in uniform, but his gun was out. His eyes weren't on me. All of his attention was for Adam. Of course, it didn't take a genius to figure out which one of us would be the bigger threat. If I looked like I felt, I looked tired, scared, and hurt. I put my hands up anyway.
"Mr. Hauptmann," said the armed man, stopping just inside the bay door, but in the middle of the open space, so that the Passat didn't interfere with his ability to cover both of us. He was younger than me, and he was wearing slacks and a jacket and tie, which only made him look even younger. I noticed almost absently that True Night had fallen in the short time between when I'd first thrown open the bay doors and now.
"Adam Hauptmann," he said again.
His voice squeaked, and he winced.
"Keep your hands where we can see them," said another, calmer voice.
This one was dressed in a cheap suit and held his gun as though he'd shot people before. His eyes had that look that let you know he'd shoot right now, too, and sleep like a baby that night.
"Agent Dan Orton, Cantrip. This is my partner, Agent Kerry Kent. You are Adam Hauptmann and his wife, Mercedes?"
"Feds." I felt my lip curl.
"That's right," Adam agreed. "Can you tell me what happened tonight?"
"You're here in response to my call?"
Adam asked instead of answering him.
"That's right."
"Then," said Adam gently, "you already know some of it. I think we'll call my lawyer before the rest."
I'd have spent the night repeating what happened endlessly to a series of people who all would hope for the real story. I'd done it before. With Adam present, neither of us said anything because they weren't letting Adam call the lawyer. Agent Orton of CNTRP, better known as Cantrip, and Agent Kent, the nervous rookie, wanted to arrest us on general principle because Adam was a werewolf and there was a dead body on the ground, and possibly because they weren't happy with our not talking to them. Luckily, we were under the local police jurisdiction, barely, because Adam's initial call had only told them that there was a man who might have been responsible for murder and arson trying to break into my garage. Human attacking human, even if she was the wife of a werewolf, was not enough to allow Cantrip to take over the case. We didn't correct them when they speculated that our intruder was the dead man. We said nothing about a supernatural creature who could turn into a volcanic dog and cause earthquakes, because Cantrip was dangerous. There were people in Cantrip who would love to see us just disappear, maybe into Guantanamo Bay. There were rumors, unsubstantiated, that a whole prison block was built to hold shapeshifters and fae. Maybe they would just report that we had escaped before they could question us and hide the bodies. Adam, because he was a monster, and me, because I slept with monsters. When I'd shifted to Coyote in front of Tony a few months ago, I'd also shifted in front of a Cantrip agent named Armstrong. He told me he wouldn't say anything about it. And apparently, based on these two, he had not. There were good people in Cantrip, too. Armstrong was a good person, so I knew that wasn't just a pretend thing, like Santa Claus. But a growing number of incidents between Cantrip and werewolves or the half-fae who'd been left to defend themselves when the full-blooded fae disappeared indicated that the good agents were in a minority. The fire department arrived on the heels of the feds, took a good look around for hot spots, none, marveled at the damn big hole in the floor, and left with the promise of sending out someone to evaluate the scene in daylight. EMTs arrived while the fire department was still there. One guy sat me down and looked me over with a flashlight, while the younger Cantrip agent took it upon himself to make sure I didn't make a break for it. The EMT made a sympathetic sound when he looked at my burns.
"I bet those hurt, Chica," he said. "I have good news and bad news."
"Hit me," I told him.
"Good news is that these all qualify as minor burns, no matter how nasty they feel."
"Bad news?"
"I think your cheek is going to scar. There's some chance that it will fade, but you've got dark skin like me, and dark skin and burns aren't a happy combination. Also, there's nothing to do for the burns. If the air bothers them, you can try wrapping them, but that will only be easy to do with the burns on your hands. If you see any sign of infection, take yourself down to your regular doctor."
"I can deal with scars," I said with more confidence than I felt. Who knew I was vain about my face? I wasn't beautiful by any stretch of the imagination, so I certainly hadn't expected the pang I felt knowing I'd bear Guayota's mark the rest of my life.
"It should look dashing," he told me, "just a pale streak, and you can make up all sorts of stories about how you got it. Frostbite on your third polar expedition, dueling scar, knife fight in the ghetto."
"I'll keep that in mind." His matter-of-fact tomfoolery settled me. Impossible to believe in volcanic dogs when this EMT was so calmly cracking jokes as he got over the heavy ground as lightly as he could.
"I do have some advice before I let you go," he told me.
"What's that?"
"Chica," he said seriously. Next time some firebug starts throwing burning things at you, run away.
I'll take that under advisement, I promised him solemnly. The second EMT came back from looking for other victims.
There's a finger in the back seat of the car in there, he said. Does anyone know who it belongs to and if I should get it in ice? It might need to be reattached. Or is it evidence and I need to leave it alone?
I just shook my head, unwilling to talk in front of the cantrip agent, and left the two EMTs to their debate. I wandered back over toward Adam. I don't know what the EMTs decided, but they left before the police cars started showing up. The Kennewick police arrived while the fire department was still having a look-see, though the big red trucks toddled off soon thereafter. The local police interrupted the stalemate of our not talking and the cantrip agents not letting us call our lawyer. Not that we talked to the local police either, but their presence put a damper on the feds. Tony wasn't with the police who came, but Willis was.
Word is that this was your husband's ex-wife's stalker, Willis told me after he'd gone inside to see the hole for himself.
His suit was muddy, and so were his hands, so he must have gone down and followed the tunnel like Adam had. He sounded grumpy.
He caused this? He glanced around the remains of my shop. It was some kind of bomb, maybe?
Dan Orton and his sidekick were trying to work on Adam without antagonizing the police. They were ignoring me because I wasn't a werewolf. Adam had subtly eased them farther away from me while I talked to Willis. I looked at the cantrip agents thoughtfully, then at Willis. You know that site we both looked at yesterday? I kept my voice down. He grunted, but his eyes were sharp. I think this incident has a lot to do with that other. You and Tony should show up at tomorrow's deposition when Adam and I talk in the presence of our lawyer, the one we still need to call. He looked at me, a long, cool look.
The crime you are referring to is officially a cantrip case, and neither I nor Detective Montenegro are your puppets to call.
Despite the hostile words, he sounded less grumpy than he had been. It was my turn to grunt. Fine by me. He couldn't fool me. Now that he knew the two were connected, you couldn't keep him away with a legion of superheroes. He'd tell Tony, and they'd both be there tomorrow.
Does a dead body with a bullet in his forehead belong to the stalker? He asked.
Tomorrow Adam and I will be happy to talk, I said, firmly keeping myself from explaining. You mind if I call our lawyer? He glanced at the cantrip agents and smiled grimly.
You aren't under arrest. Without the assurance that there was magic afoot here, cantrip doesn't have the authority, and I am not inclined to arrest anyone without more information. Without an arrest, I don't see that I have any say over what you do.
My phone was intact, which was something of a miracle in and of itself. Willis put himself between me and the cantrip agents while I called the PAC's lawyers. Their phone system forwarded me to the lawyer on call, and the woman who answered sounded harried. I could hear kids screaming in the background, but since the screams were interspaced with wild laughter, I wasn't too concerned.
Trevelyan, she said in a breathless voice.
She cleared her throat and continued in a much more lawyerly fashion, though her voice was still very Marilyn Monroe.
Good evening, Miss Houtman. How can I help?
I gave her a brief explanation. Stalker, break-in, dead body. Not telling her anything Willis, who was watching me with grim amusement, didn't already know. I told her Adam wanted to get out of here tonight and give a statement tomorrow.
Don't say anything, she said. Don't let Adam say anything. I'll be right there.
She strode onto the scene, a 5-foot-nothing warrior with iron-gray hair and eyes clear and sharp blue. She took one good long look around and marched up to Clay Willis, having evidently determined he was in charge.
"Are my clients under arrest?" she asked Willis.
Adam, trailing his pair of feds, approached in time for Willis to answer, "No, ma'am."
"We still have some questions," said Agent Orton,
"which my clients will answer tomorrow in my office."
She gave them her card.
"Call that number tomorrow at 8:30 sharp, and someone will tell you when to come."
She ushered Adam and me to Adam's car.
"Now run while you can," she murmured. "I will do the same. The grandmother magic will wear off in a minute, and someone will decide that the dead body means they should arrest someone. Don't answer your phone unless you know the number, and come into my office tomorrow at 7:30.
She's good, I said. Tough, smart, and funny as a bonus. I wonder if there really is grandmother magic.
For what we pay her, she'd better be good, agreed Adam. She doesn't need grandmother magic to make people scramble at her command.
He pressed a button on his steering wheel and said,
Call Warren.
A woman's voice from his dash said, Calling.
Boss, Warren answered. Everyone okay? Mercy singed, but still swinging. Good to hear. I got quite an earful from your security chief who deleted a lot of interesting material. Then you know most of it. I need you to get everyone out of our house right now. Apparently Christy Stalker is some kind of supernatural who can set things on fire. You want me to take him home?
Warren asked. Adam took in a deep breath.
What do you think? I think that our place got a lot of attention in the press when those rogue agents kidnapped Kyle. Suggestions? How about Honey's place? It's big enough to house everyone if we don't all need bedrooms, and it hasn't been plastered all over the newspaper.
Honey's house was in Finley, too. Another large house like ours, though it wasn't built to be a pack den, so while there was plenty of room, it was short on beds.
Sounds good. Call Honey, then get everyone out of the house. You two okay?
Adam's eyes traveled to me.
Yes. Kyle called about 10 minutes ago and said to tell you that a Gary laughing dog is at our house and would like to talk to Mercy on a matter of some urgency. Tell him we'll be right there.
Adam pulled a U-turn.
We'll move them on to Honey's house. Call me if Honey has a problem and we'll come up with something else. Right. Is laughing dog the guy Mercy visited in prison?
I said, yes. There was a little pause.
So he broke out of jail?
I said, yes, again.
Kyle doesn't know that, Warren said. If the wrong things happen, Kyle could lose his license to practice law for having him in the house. You get everyone safe, said Adam, and I'll take care of Kyle. Moving on it, boss.
Warren hung up the phone. Do you think he'll go after our house, I asked. Wyota, I mean?
I don't know enough about him to be making predictions,
Adam said. Why do you think that he believes she... I stopped speaking.
What?
I almost saw it then. I sat up straighter and turned toward Adam. I'm stupid. When Tony took me to look at the crime scene in the hayfield, I thought for an instant that one of the bodies he'd left was Christie's. The ghost could have been her sister. She was the right age, right hair color, and right body type. All of the women were, I think, though it wouldn't hurt to double check.
We need to find out who this guy is, said Adam grimly. And we need to find the walking stick, so that Beauclair doesn't kill us before Floris does.
We have his name, I said. Guayota. That might help. And Z gave Tad some insight he shared with me about Beauclair and why not running Coyote down before Sunday might not mean disaster. He glanced my way and back at the road, inviting me to keep talking. So I explained Z's reasoning. When I was finished, Adam gave me a short nod.
Might work. It would be better to have the walking stick, but beggars can't be choosers.
Z's insights into the problem with Beauclair and the walking stick have showed me I need to start thinking outside the box more, I said.
Oh?
Adam glanced at me, then back at the road. I thought we should apply that kind of thinking to the matter of Christy Stalker. He gave me a skeptical look. No, really, I said. Now that we know that Floris is really this nasty, fiery, super-powerful, nothing-can-kill-me demon from hell, maybe we should consider just giving Christy to him. He laughed. I'm serious, I said. And I was, really, if only a little bit.
Right, he said affectionately. I know exactly how serious you are. We've got a 20-minute drive ahead. Why don't you close your eyes and rest up?
It sounded like a plan. My hands hurt, my hip hurt, my cheek throbbed, and someone had thrown a finger at me, and I hadn't eaten today. Adam's hand curled around the top of my knee, and I relaxed and let myself drift off. Nothing was so bad that Adam's touch couldn't make it better, even if he wouldn't let me give Christy to the fire dog from hell. 8. Kyle let us in with a sincere, heartfelt gratitude that didn't speak well of his guests. He frowned at my face. The EMT told me the cheek will probably scar, but putting stuff on it won't help, I told him. He also advised avoiding fights where throwing fire is involved.
I know of something that might help, Kyle said. I'll talk to my hairdresser and see if I can't get you some. Of course, if you keep fighting with people who throw fire at you, it's unlikely to be of any help in the long run.
Let's get through with Gary Laughing Dog first, said Adam. And then I'll tell you what happened tonight at Mercy's garage.
I know most of it, Kyle said. Warren called a while ago and gave me a play-by-play, but the conversation was in my bedroom and I haven't passed anything along just yet.
He ushered us to the ground floor sitting room where the defensive posture of our newest wolf put Adam on edge. Zack had pushed himself as far into the corner of the sofa as he could get. Gary Laughing Dog, barefoot and dressed in jeans and a stained white T-shirt, was sitting on the back of the same couch, though right in the center of it, but he was leaning toward Zack, using body language to put pressure on the wolf.
So, Laughing Dog said as we came into the room, do you swing the same way as your host, Zack? I usually go for women, but you're cute enough I could do you if you want.
No, Adam said, and he wasn't answering the question Gary had raised.
Laughing Dog turned to look at Adam, his posture relaxed. He'd known we were coming in, and the pressure he was putting on Zack was to see what we would do. His eyes widened as he took in Adam.
I do you, too.
He wasn't lying.
Almost, sister, you picked a real catch.
It was I who caught her, Adam said softly. It took years, and no, not interested, and neither is Zack. If you don't back off him, we may never find out just what it is that you have to tell my wife. That would be too bad.
Zack doesn't mind me, said Laughing Dog with one of those false friendly smiles he'd used on me. Do you, Zack?
One, said Adam coolly.
You're going to count to three, really? How old do you think I am?
Kyle stalked over to the couch, grabbed Laughing Dog by the back of his T-shirt, and jerked him all the way off the couch and onto the floor. I'd have thought such a fit of violence was completely out of character for Kyle, but somehow it didn't seem forced. Maybe Gary Laughing Dog had the same effect on people that I occasionally did.
I told you to back the fuck off, Kyle snarled. You are a temporary guest in my house, and I am done with you.
Laughing Dog, sprawled out on the floor, didn't look the least bit fussed.
Sorry, he said unrepentantly. I can't help but push them when they squirm.
Uncomfortable is one thing, said Kyle, who also tended to push people when they squirmed. Scared is another. Laughing Dog froze and glanced up at Zack, who hadn't moved from his corner and was not looking at anyone. He was, in fact, barely breathing. Submissive wolves don't go around cringing. Peter, Honey's mate, had been a good fighter. Submissive means a wolf has no desire to be in charge.
Ah, damn it all, Laughing Dog said, sitting up. I didn't catch it. Sometimes it's easy to get caught up and not notice what my nose tells me. I know what no means, kid. No always means no.
Mercy, Adam said. You and Kyle take Laughing Dog somewhere else and let me talk to Zack. Evidently, no doesn't always mean no.
Zack came to life at that.
I'm fine, he said hurriedly.
No, said Laughing Dog softly.
He pushed himself across the floor until he was on the other side of the room from the couch.
I don't think so, man. But no harm will come to you here, right?
Adam looked at Zack, then looked at me.
What do you think?
I think I overreacted, said Zack before I could say anything.
He sounded humiliated.
I'm sorry.
Nah, kid, said Laughing Dog. Not overreacting when you don't know me, but someone needs to teach you to do something more effective than just locking down.
He frowned at me. Apparently it was my fault that he'd scared Zack. Kyle sat down on the other end of the couch from Zack.
Give him space and leave him alone, he said.
Kyle was a divorce attorney. He had experience dealing with broken people. I'd only been a broken person, so Kyle was the person to listen to. I nodded at Kyle to give his assessment my support. Adam, after looking around, pulled a wingback chair over until the back was resting against the edge of the couch. When he sat in it, it put him between Zack and everyone else in the room, and it gave Zack a barrier between him and Adam. I sat on the chair arm. Laughing Dog moved to a chair that was across the room, but still gave Zack a good view of him. He looked at Kyle.
"You know," he said, "I can do a little rough since that seems to be your thing, and you look like a man who likes the boys rather than the girls."
"Not interested," said Kyle shortly.
"See," said Laughing Dog to the room at large, though there was no doubt to whom he addressed his words. "That's how it's done. Go soak yourself in oil and light a match in two short words."
"What did you want to talk to me about, Gary?" I asked. If I let Laughing Dog keep talking without direction, someone was going to get hurt. He looked at the burn on my cheek.
"I think you met the guy I came to warn you about. If you put bag balm on that, it will feel better. Might even keep it from scarring. I was hoping to find you before he did, but make him phone calls from..."
He glanced at Kyle.
"Make him phone calls to tell someone that an angry volcano god is going to attack her is hard enough when you know her well enough that you do have her phone number. It also takes me time to come off a seeing like the one I had when you came to visit me. Took me a little longer to decide I had an obligation to find you and give you a little clearer warning. Getting here, well, for such as you and me, it wasn't a big thing, but it took time, too."
"Don't tell Kyle, the lawyer, that the man talking to us had just escaped from prison." I got the message, not that I needed it. Adam had told me before we came in that Kyle's best defense was not to know that Laughing Dog had escaped from prison.
"What do you know about this angry volcano god?" Adam asked slowly.
"Some. Not a lot. But hopefully enough that you can find out more. I got a lot of random information. Do either of you know what El Tete means?"
Kyle frowned.
"In reference to what?"
"To Guayota," Laughing Dog said.
"Coyote?" asked Zack.
"No, Guayota," said Kyle. "Starts with a G, and it's the name of one of the gods of Tenerife."
"Tenerife?" I asked.
"The Canary Islands?" asked Adam. "Tenerife is one of the bigger islands in the Canaries, right?"
I'm a history major, so once Adam jogged my memory, I pulled up a few random factoids. I'm a magpie of history trivia. Spain had conquered the islands that were not far off the coast of Africa over the course of a century, just in time for them to be used as supply ports for Columbus and most of the Spanish explorers of the New World. I knew a couple of other very random things. First, at the behest of the King of Spain, Canary Islanders had settled what became San Antonio, Texas, and set up the first official government in Texas. Second, the original natives of the islands hadn't been of African phenotype. That and the local island story that there was a mysterious island among the Canaries that disappeared and reappeared had been used to fuel all sorts of Atlantis rumors. None of what I knew appeared to be useful in the present situation, so I kept my mouth shut.
"That's right," Kyle said. "My folks used to vacation there every year. Still do, for all I know. I haven't talked to them much since... well, since. Anyway..."
He spoke quickly, to get the attention off events that were still painful. Kyle seldom spoke about his family, who had disowned him when he told them he was gay.
"There was this old woman at my parents' favorite hotel who watched kids so that the adults could go play. The native Canarians who worked at the hotel swore she was a witch. There are a lot of witches on the Canary Islands. Before I met Warren, I pretty much dismissed all of that as superstition, but now... anyway, the story of Guayota was one of her favorites. One hellish vacation, I heard it 5 times in 3 days.
He frowned.
"She's the only one I heard it from, so you should check it out somewhere else. I'm pretty sure she made parts of it up."
"Keep going," I told him. "We'll consult Wikipedia and the library later. Promise."
"It would be nice," Laughing Dog said with feeling, "to hear something to put what I know in context. It might even help me make some of the odd things more useful. Please, tell us this story about Guayota."
"Okay," Kyle said. "Okay, I'll tell you what I know." He leaned forward, and I don't know how he did it, but with a bit of body language and a little warble in his voice, he called to mind a little old lady. I'd always thought that he'd had some drama training at some point.
"There is a huge
huge old volcano on Tenerife called El Teide. It's the tallest peak in Spain and one of the tallest volcanoes in the world. The old people who once lived on the island called it Echede, which means either hell or the gates of hell, depending upon the person you ask. Guayota lived in El Teide, either guarding the door, ruling there, or both. Only the old ones could tell you for certain, and they are gone long, long ago.
His voice softened as he talked, and he pulled an accent out of his memory and added it to the story. The chair arm I sat on was uncomfortable, so I slid off it onto the floor. The floor was better, especially when I set my back against the chair and leaned my head against the arm. I'd gotten the post-danger jitters over with while we waited for the cantrip agents to figure out that Adam wasn't going to talk until he was good and ready. Now I was just tired. The nap in the car had made it worse, and my eyelids fought to close.
Now Guayota was like the Greek Titans, a violent and impetuous creature of great power. He roamed the mountain in the shape of a great black hairy dog with red eyes, and tragedy befell any who met him in his runs, because he would eat them up. One bite for children, two for mothers, or three for big warriors who came to fight him.
Harry? I thought about it. Maybe the way his skin had seemed to drip and crack could be described as hairy, or maybe he had another form, too.
Charming story to tell children, said Laughing Dog. I thought so, too, agreed Kyle cheerfully in his own voice.
Then there was a little pause as he remembered that Laughing Dog didn't deserve a cheerful reply. He continued in a more guarded tone.
My littlest sister had nightmares, and when my parents arranged a sightseeing tour up the side of the old volcano, they couldn't figure out why she wouldn't go.
Kyle recloaked himself in the persona of the old woman and continued.
Guayota was terrifying, but he was also lonesome. Every day he would look up and see Magek, the sun, running her path in the sky. He thought her beautiful and wondrous, and him so lonely and miserable on that mountain. So that old Guayota, he plotted to take her for his own.
Hadn't Guayota made some reference to the sun when he was talking about Christy? I tried to visualize Kyle's story, to put Flores in the place of Guayota, but all I could see was a wizened old witch with a room full of kids that she was scaring. Witches feed off other people's pain. I wondered if they could feed off terror as well.
So one day he jumped, the old devil. He jumped out of the top of El Teide and captured her for himself. Loud she cried and hard she fought. But she was no match for old Guayota. She could not burn him with her fierceness, for though she was the fire of day, he was born in the fire of the earth, which is more ferocious even than the sun. Nor could she blind him with her bright beauty, because his eyes were used to the molten rock of his home. And when she got too bright for his eyes, the old dog, he just closed his eyes and used his ears and his nose, which were as sharp as any shepherd's dog's, and more so. He took her down to his home and caged her inside the volcano. For weeks the sky was dark and smoke filled the air. It was then that Guayota's children were born, while he held Magek in his caves. They are the Tibicenas, fierce, hairy black dogs that emerged from the mountain in those days when Guayota held Magek his prisoner. The only light that shone on Tenerife was Magek's light, escaping here and there from the caves in the old volcano, and the light of the Tibicenas' eyes. But the people of the island were frightened that they had no sun. They called and prayed to Ashaman, he who created the world. Ashaman listened to the cries of the people and came down to the volcano to rescue Magek. Quiotha fought mightily because he did not want to give up, Magek. The volcano spewed fire and rock, and many died as the two gods battled. At last, knowing that he could not win, Quiotha called up the fires of the earth to swallow the island and Magek so that if he could not have her, neither could anyone else. A shaman took Quiotha and stuffed him in the volcano, stopping the fire and smoke and rescuing the people of the island. He freed Magek and sent her racing in the sky once more, fierce and bright as she should be. But she is always watchful when she flies over the top of El Teide, lest old Quiotha catch her once again.
Kyle stopped, smiled a little.
I told the story to my dad once. He told me that it was a primitive attempt to explain a volcanic eruption. El Teide is an active volcano. The last eruption was a couple hundred years ago. He also pointed out that the reactions on the sun's surface are hotter than any volcano magma.
Talk turned to the night's adventures, which Adam was more than capable of telling.
I drifted off into a dream of a witch who changed children into great shaggy black dogs that looked like long-haired versions of the dog I'd shot, the one who turned into a man. The man raised his dead head to meet my eyes with his. His eyes were the color of lava.
"Mercy," he said. "Where is my son?"
"Mercy, wake up," said Adam.
I sat up like a scalded cat and winced because everything hurt, especially the burn on my cheek.
"Okay," said Laughing Dog. "Adam's been filling us in on your night. Were you awake for all of Kyle's story?"
I yawned. "Yep, I didn't fall asleep until we got to our part. Sorry, long day."
"Fine."
Laughing Dog settled back into his chair, one leg up, and the other doing a restless dance on the floor.
"Kyle's story makes me pretty sure that Quiotha is one of the great Manitous."
I frowned at him. Manitou was an Algonquin word for spirit, the spirit that lived in all things, in rocks, in rivers, in mountains. Great Manitou. I made some quick jumps of logic. "When you say Great Manitous, you're talking about creatures like Coyote?"
"That's right. Mostly right. No."
He made a frustrated sound.
"Coyote, Raven, Wolf are different than Manitous. Coyote is a spirit of mischief, of second chances, of adaptation, the archetype of coyotes. It is true that he shares characteristics with the Great Manitous. Like him, they can take the shape of people, though they are not people. They are powerful in their sphere of influence. Mostly, the Great Manitous ignore us and pay attention only to those things that matter to them. The Columbia has a Great Manitou. I can feel it sometimes, but I've never heard of it manifesting itself, not even in stories."
"You think Quiotha is a Great Manitou, the spirit of the volcano," I said. "Sort of like Pele in Hawaii?" He nodded. "So what is he doing here? Shouldn't he be stuck somewhere within a few thousand miles of where he belongs?"
"I don't know. Maybe he grew bored."
He shrugged.
"If he were Coyote, that would be the answer, wouldn't it? Maybe Quiotha grew lonely. The only thing I know is that although Great Manitous can manifest and travel for a time, they do need a strong connection to their spirit home. Without that connection, they will return to their spirit shape and be pulled home."
"So we need to find out what his connection is," said Adam.
"Right," agreed Laughing Dog. "But here's the part that had me..."
He substituted "driven to find you" for "breaking out of jail." He was going to have to be smoother if he didn't want Kyle to realize something was up. At least he was careful to look at me and not Kyle when he changed up his words. Looking at Kyle would have been a dead giveaway.
"I had a few dreams. Didn't mean much to me until you showed up, and I had that freaking nasty seeing. I would have let it go, but then I had a worse dream."
"What already?" I said.
"Some things you need to know about my gift."
He said it with his fingers as quotes, so I knew what he thought about his gift from Coyote. "Okay."
"One, it usually comes in dreams or small bits. Big seeings aren't that common. 2, sometimes I see the future, sometimes the past. Most times it's the present, only somewhere else where I can't freaking do anything about anything."
I nodded.
"Finally, When I do see the future, while it is possible to change it, the reason I see that particular future is because it has become the most likely scenario, and it's pretty close to being set in stone.
So, what did you dream?
There is a room with a Texas flag on the wall and paintings of dogs. On the floor is this woman lying dead. At first I thought she was you, but she isn't. There's a white pit bull on the floor beside her with its throat torn out.
I jerked my head up. Is she a small woman? Hispanic?
She was dead, Mercy, and lying on the floor. I didn't have a measuring stick. Could have been Hispanic or Indian, which is why I thought it was you originally. She opens her eyes, says your name, then she's dead again.
You know who it is, Adam said.
I stood up. You couldn't have told me this an hour ago? Adam, it's Hoel's wife, the one who talked to Christy about dogs. We've got to go right now.
He stood up and took in the room at a glance.
You come too, Laughing Dog. We'll put you up for the night and help you get where you need to be in the morning.
Fine, Gary said a little reluctantly. I didn't think he wanted to do anything more now that he'd given us the information he had.
Zack,
Adam said.
Yes, sir.
Anyone gives you a hard time, you tell me or Warren, or you can tell Kyle and he'll tell us.
Adam named the people Zack would be most familiar with.
We'll take care of it, okay? You are safe here.
The submissive wolf looked away, his mouth pinched in at the corners. Adam had started out of the room, but the other's lack of response had him turn back around.
You will tell one of us.
It was a full-on order. I could feel the stir of pack magic. Zack threw back his head in a full temper.
Fine.
Adam nodded once, then jogged out of the house. He stopped at the door.
Kyle, you and Zack get overnight bags packed and head out to Honey's. This place has been in the papers in connection with Mercy and the pack, and that makes it too easy for him to find.
Okay, Kyle said. I know where Honey lives, I think. If I get turned around, I'll call Warren.
South Kennewick, I told Adam for directions as we hopped into the SUV, off Olympia.
Fresa Canario, he said after we were well on our way. Warren told me a while ago that the breed originated on the Canary Islands.
Where are we going and why am I going with you? Asked Laughing Dog.
Lucia is a friend. She has a big white Staffordshire Terrier. I glanced over my shoulder at Laughing Dog. Pitbull, in layman terms. You didn't dream of her until after we left you at the prison.
That's right.
It was right afterward that Honey and I went to visit with her. My fault if something happened to Lucia. Why else would Floris pay any attention to her at all?
And you are bringing me with you because?
He asked again.
Because Kyle is a lawyer and could lose his license to practice if it comes out that you are at his house, said Adam. I promised his partner I'd look after him.
Partner, Laughing Dog said musingly.
Warren, right? That's the other man you mentioned. I knew Kyle Brooks was tied up with the werewolves after reading about the group that attacked him a few months ago. That's why I went there. I got turned around, and by the time I figured out where I was, his house was a lot closer than yours, and I was on foot. 4 feet. I thought he'd be a werewolf, but as soon as he answered the door, I could tell that he wasn't. It intrigued me.
Adam's voice was like sandpaper when he said,
In my pack, people can date whoever they like.
Hey, I'm not pointing fingers, man, said Laughing Dog. Just explaining why my thoughts went right to look at Zack. But a deaf and blind man could tell that there is nothing between them. So, his partner is this other werewolf.
He breathed out through his nose in a huff of amusement.
A gay werewolf. I never thought I'd see the day that a pack let a gay werewolf live.
Gary, I said, shut up before someone hurts you.
Warren, said Adam at the same time, survived a lot of idiots with that attitude.
He paused.
And you ought to listen to Mercy's advice.
We made it to Hoel and Lucia's house about 20 minutes after we'd left Kyle's house, most of it in silence. I'd like to have believed that we'd quelled Gary, but his silence was punctuated with amusement that was very palpable. As soon as we pulled into the driveway, I knew there was something wrong. No dogs were barking. I knocked on the door, the men at my back. When the door opened and Lucia peered around it, my breath left my mouth in a whoosh of relief.
Mercy?
She asked. She seemed distracted and worried. I nodded.
Yes, sorry to come over so late without warning you first, but the matter was urgent. I think that Christy Stalker is a little more dangerous than we thought, and I might have let him right to your door. I know it's late, but can we come in to talk?
She gave the man a cautious look.
This is Gary Laughing Dog, I told her, my half-brother. That was a simpler explanation for his presence than any other I could come up with on short notice, and it had the additional benefit of being true. I could feel his eyes boring holes in my back, but he didn't comment. And this is my husband, Adam.
The werewolf, he said,
and it was just exactly the right thing to say, because she smiled a little.
Your husband has worked for me a couple of times.
I thought you looked familiar. Sure, come on in. She opened the door, and we trailed behind her into the house. She saw me look around. The dogs are back in their kennels for dinner. I'll bring Aruba back in for the night in an hour or so. The rest kennel outside. Why aren't they barking? I asked. I was worried something had happened to you. She smiled again as she led us into the living room, but there was tension around her eyes. No, we teach them not to bark at night unless they are put on watch. That way our neighbors do not complain about our dogs. Where's Hoel? I asked, sitting down on the same couch as last time. She shook her head, and I realized that Hoel was what she was worried about, not us. He's late. I opened my mouth to say something as reassuring as I could, given that I didn't have a clue why he'd be late, when my eyes fell on the flag on the opposite wall, the one Gary had seen in his vision. Hoel is from Texas, I said, staring at the flag on the wall, thinking that what had popped into my head was absolutely ridiculous, stupid. But there was that flag staring me in the face, so I had to ask. Is his family by any chance from San Antonio? She nodded. That's right, San Antonio. He was up here visiting some cousins when we met. We moved to Texas first, but I got homesick and we moved back to the Tri-Cities. A handful of families had been shipped to Texas from the Canary Islands by the King of Spain 3 centuries ago. There was supposed to have been a much larger immigration, but the whole plan had stalled out for reasons that had escaped my magpie collection of historical trivia. 3 centuries was a lot of time, and San Antonio was a huge city. Assuming Gary was right, Guayota was a Manitou, the spirit of the volcano, and he needed something with him that tied him to the Canary Islands. He'd said that the dog I'd killed, his child, was immortal, tied to mortal flesh. And when Guayota left, the dog had turned into a man. Kyle had talked about Tibicenas, Guayota's children, who were black dogs. What if it was the Tibicenas that served as Guayota's ties to the volcano? I'd killed the mortal flesh his Tibicena was tied to. What if he needed to find another man to bind to the Tibicena? What if that man had to be descended from a Canary Islander? Maybe Lucia and Hoel's troubles weren't because I'd come to them for help. Do you know, I asked carefully, if Hoel is one of the Canarios? Adam looked at me sharply. A descendant of the Canary Islanders who settled in Texas? She gave me a tentative smile. His mother never lets anyone forget it. She's a proud woman, and she swears that not only were they Canarios, but her family actually was Guanche, descended from the original inhabitants of the islands before Spain conquered it about 700 years ago. Her smile broadened. She talks about moving back there someday. I really hope that she does. We could vacation in the tropics and also see her less often. Win-win in my book.
We should get out of here, said Gary, looking at the framed flag and sounding nervous.
He looked at Lucia and seemed to collect himself.
Ma'am, Mercy brought us here because she is worried that Christy Stalker might be after you because you helped her.
That's pretty far-fetched, said Lucia. Adam looked at Gary and said,
Why don't we take you to dinner and tell you some tall tales, and you can decide if you want to believe us or not. You pick the restaurant, take your own car, and leave a message for your husband. I think that we might all be easier in a more neutral location.
She looked at Adam, because people just do. Humans are not immune to the reassurance that he brings with him like an invisible cloak. Part of it is being alpha, and part of it is just Adam.
I think, my husband said, giving the Lone Star flag a thoughtful look,
Going out might be a very good idea.
She led the way to a family-style Mexican restaurant off Highway 395 where there were lots of people even at 9 at night. No one said anything until we'd all ordered and the waiter had brought our drinks. Gary shot a glance at me to see if I wanted to start. I took a chip and dipped it into salsa and gave Adam a look. If Adam told her, she'd probably believe him. It was the air of authority and no nonsense. He raised an eyebrow, and I nodded at him. You tell her, I said. You're good at making this kind of stuff make sense. So while I ate chips like I hadn't eaten in days, which was sort of true, Adam told Lucia how Christy's stalker boyfriend had broken into my garage and turned into a fiery demon dog from the Canary Islands. He combined the immediate narrative with the story Kyle had told us later and managed to make it sound plausible. He left out Gary's jailbreak. Food came before Adam was finished, and I ate as quickly as I could because I knew that there was a real chance that dinner would be over before I was done eating. She might try to storm out, certain that we were crazy. Or maybe she'd try to go look for Howell immediately. We'd have to stop her for her own safety. And then there would be other things more urgent than food. Gary was eating the same way I was, maybe for the same reasons. So, she said carefully, Juan Flores is really a volcanic deity named Guayota who thinks that your ex-wife Christy is, what, some sort of reincarnation of the sun goddess he captured and raped thousands of years ago? I know, right? I said, swallowing hastily. I had that same moment of disbelief, but for me it was when he threw his finger at me and it burned through the top of the passat I was standing on. She was silent for a moment, looking at the burn on my cheek. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything about the finger, but it kept coming up in my thoughts. I've never had a finger thrown at me before. A new and improved addition to my creepy Hall of Fame nightmares. And you think that because I helped you a little, she pinched her thumb and index finger together to show everyone how little, he will come after me? Because this one, she indicated Laughing Dog with a jerk of her chin, had a dream? That's what I thought when Gary told us about his dream, I told her, setting down my fork. I wasn't hungry anymore. That Guayota might have come after you because you helped us, but now I think that because I killed the human one of his Tibisenas was tied to, he needs to find another one. Immortal Tibisena tied to a mortal. A mortal who was descended from the land where his volcano had fertilized the soil the people ate from. I think, if I understand what Guayota is, the spirit of a Canary Islands volcano, that he needed a descendant of the Canary Islands to recreate the physical form of his Tibisena. I think that maybe he sought Howell out because his family came from the Canaries, where Guayota originated. She hadn't run away yet. Adam gave me a thoughtful look. When did you come up with this look? Maybe he's coming because you helped us, I told her. But you can't contact Howell. And Guayota is a spirit, a god, demon, or whatever, from the Canary Islands. It might be a coincidence. My brother here knows a little about the kinds of spirits that dwell in mountains. Gary kept reacting when I claimed him as a relative. I wasn't sure whether he was happy, unhappy, or just surprised by it. I just ignored him and continued on. He told us that Guayota needs a connection to his home to function here. I think the dogs are that connection. Now that one of them is dead, he needs a replacement. I think the coincidence was that I came to ask you about the dogs. Maybe if there was some kind of deeper connection between Howell and Guayota, maybe it wasn't such an odd thing that Howell was working with dogs. I believe that your husband meets Guayota's need for a descendant of the islands, and there are probably not a lot of Canary Islanders in the Tri-Cities. I think he's taken your husband and is forcing him to become one of his Tibisenas. She paled, pulled out her cell phone, and dialed. Instead of Howell's voice telling her to leave a message, we all heard the recording advising her that the customer who had the number she dialed was not available. He'd either powered his cell phone off, run it out of battery, or destroyed it. We have told you quite a story, I told Lucia. I swear to you that the danger is real. If you don't wish us to keep you safe, I understand. If you don't believe us, That's okay, too. But I think you need to find a safe place to be for a few days until we can destroy Guayota.
I'm not sure that's possible, Laughing Dog murmured,
and I kicked him under the table, even though I didn't think Lucia had heard. She put her phone back in her purse with shaking hands.